Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. Over the holiday, we received word that Martha's Vineyard resident Janet Messineo had died after a diagnosis of ALS. While she was known for her skill as a surf cast fisherman, writer, and taxidermist, it was her warmth, kindness, and generosity of spirit that made an impact on those who knew her. Today, we listen back to a conversation with Janet recorded in the summer of 2019 when her book Casting Into the Light was published. Fishing is a popular recreational activity, and there are many Cape and Island residents and visitors who consider themselves fishermen. For some, fishing is more than a recreational activity. It's a passion. Janet Messineo is one of those individuals, and her memoir out today is titled Casting Into the Light, Tales of a Fishing Life. Welcome back, I should say. Good to see you.
Thank you, Mindy. It's so nice to be here.
So let's start our conversation with you reading an excerpt from the first chapter of the book.
Okay. During the off-season, from December until mid-April, I live a normal life. I work, clean the house, and cook dinners, walk the dog, pay my bills, and take care of everyday business. Come April, the first time I get my fishing rod out of its winter storage and stand in the surf up to my thighs to cast, I exhale. I feel as though I've been holding my breath for the last 5 months. My posture changes, my face relaxes, most of the aches and pains in my body melt away. I feel serene, focused, and safe. I'm home. It's the meditative place similar to where gardeners go when they kneel in the dirt and dig their fingers in the soil. People who crochet or make quilts go to that place as they sit for hours and sew thousands of tiny stitches. Musicians get lost in the chords and notes. Golfers know that place of peace when they chase a little white ball around the greens. My doctor told me that when he skis, he no longer thinks of all his responsibilities and his mind becomes calm and quiet. For me, it's fishing. Standing in the surf, casting my lure towards the horizon, I feel like I am the woman I'm meant to be. As I watch the sun rise or set, rain or shine, all those important thoughts that have been occupying my mind become trivial. I feel small under the light of the moon and a ceiling of bright stars. When I'm fishing, I feel alive and right size. After 4 decades, fishing is not something I do. It's part of my being. It's who I am. My life becomes meaningful, and I feel a part of my surroundings.
So fishing is your passion.
Yes.
It's part of who you are. Some people find their passion at an early age. Others discover it later in life. And sadly, some never find it. So you didn't grow up on the water or with a family of fishermen, but you've always had this interest in nature. So how did that manifest when you were young?
Well, that's an interesting question. Well, you know, I always, we were from the projects of Lawrence, and when we moved out of the projects, we moved to what, well, my Sicilian grandmother used to call it the farm. It was a little, you know, a little lot in Salem, New Hampshire, and there was a little bit of woods next to it. And that's really where I spent most of my time. There was a little swamp, and I used to try to, actually, my brother used to like to do harm to the frogs, and so I used to try to catch them so he wouldn't be able to catch them. So, you know, I've always been that hunter-gatherer.
Now, you came of age in New Hampshire, you said, in the 1960s and 70s, and like many young adults, you decided the conventional path of settling down, getting a job, and starting a family, that was not for you. After a few years of traveling and living and working on the West Coast and then back east, you made your way to the vineyard in 1972. So why the vineyard?
Well, I actually first landed on the island in 1966, right after I left home, after I graduated from high school. I met my first husband there. I got married the first time at 19, a little too young. I always think it's dress rehearsal the first time you get married. But, you know, I mean, he was a good guy. It was a, you know, we had fun. And, yeah, so we ended up going to California for a while and then coming back to the vineyard in 71. But, you know, when I first moved there in 66, it just drew me. You know, the friends that I made there in the 60s, when I came back in the 70s, I was still close to everybody.
So when did your interest in fishing on the vineyard begin?
Well, I was 28 years old. And I bought my boyfriend at the time a fishing rod. And, I guess you know, this the longest story is in my book. And when I moved back to the island in the 70s, I went with my friends Eddie and Donna Montessin. He had a four-wheel drive, a Toyota Land Cruiser, I'll never forget. And it was my first ride on Chappaquiddick. Mm. And he caught this bonita, and we ate it. And to me, you know, he probably took 1,000 casts. But to me, he threw this little shiny silver thing in this vast ocean, and he caught a fish. And I thought, oh, my God, that's like a miracle. You know, how did he do that? I want to do that. You know, I want to learn.
So as your interest in fishing grew, you write you wanted to be a good fisherman, not just a good female fisherman. Why was that so important to you?
Well, because, you know, as I started to fish after the first couple of years, I realized there was a hierarchy. You know, there was little groups of fishermen. And, of course, I wanted to stalk striped bass, which are basically nocturnal. And it was really hard to learn. And, you know, being a woman, I was snubbed a lot. Mm-hmm. Nobody would take me seriously. So I guess after a while, I just didn't want to learn to fish. I wanted to be one of the guys, I guess.
So today there is gear designed for women, but that wasn't the case in the 1970s. So how did you modify men's gear to work for your smaller frame?
Oh, my God. I just was not, you know, a fashion plate. My waders were always way too big. I cinched a belt around them. But, you know, the pictures of me, the archival pictures of me are pretty bad. You know, I just did the best I can. I slurped around in clothes that were way too big for me.
Yeah. So you decided that you wanted to fish from shore, not from a boat. So tell us why.
Well, you know, back in the days when I first started fishing, a boat never even came into my mind. Mm. You know, for me, just buying a fishing rod and I was a waitress. And so, you know, the money that I made and I supported myself was not, to buy a boat was totally out of realm, you know. And it just didn't interest me. I don't know why. It just didn't come into my mind.
There must have been a steep learning curve as you began your pursuit of fish. What were some of the lessons that you learned early on?
Well, let's see. It took a while, but I learned that the tides and the wind have a lot to do with feeding fish. And one of the things that I learned was tie a good knot. Mm. I lost more fish because I couldn't tie a knot.
You didn't tie a good knot.
No.
Now, fishermen are notoriously tight-lipped, especially with wash ashores and a female one at that. So was it difficult to find fishermen willing to give you tips or advice?
Oh, absolutely. And I learned early on, you don't walk up to a fisherman and say, hi, can you teach me? Or where did you get that fish? Or how did you catch it? That's the best way for them to turn their back on you. So what I started to do was observe. Mm-hmm. I'd go to a jetty and stand back and observe. And I did have a few friends. My friend Bob Jacobs, mm-hmm. We called him Hawkeye. Unfortunately, he passed away a couple of years ago. He was one of the first guys to take me. And he wouldn't teach me anything. He was the type of guy to bring me to a spot and walk away.
And go, here you go.
Yeah, here you are. You've arrived.
You had several fishing partners, but you had one mentor,
yes,
Jack. Tell us more about Jack and how you met.
Well, Jackie Catino, I had become, I could catch bluefish because there was so many bluefish around back in the 70s. And I finally got my first four-wheel drive in, I think, 1978. And so I was free to go to Chappaquiddick, you know, with all my gear. But when the sun went down, I went home because I didn't know how to fish at night. And I was at a party on Labor Day, I think 1978 or I think 78. And I met Jackie. And he came up to me and he said, oh, I can see that you can really cast. And I said, yeah, but I don't know how to find striped bass. And he said, I'll teach you. Mm. So he became my mentor. He was incredible.
Yeah. What made fishing with Jack so different from fishing with others?
Jackie and I just became, I guess we had a chemistry, I guess you'd say. Mm. You know, he was a little Portuguese guy. He was a butcher at a local market. So he was very strong. And I don't know. You know, we just became a team.
We clicked.
Yeah. And he didn't do everything for me. He made me do it myself, but I always knew he was there and he had his eye on me to make sure I was safe.
Once Jack took you under his wing, he didn't want you to share your fishing knowledge with others, particularly those who were considered Washashores. So did that make it difficult to fish with others, or did your fishing friends understand that that's how it worked?
Well, once I started fishing with Jackie, I became the same way. Mm-hmm. You know, I just didn't fish with anybody else. I didn't dare.
And then, so you and Jack were fishing exclusively for striped bass.
Yes.
Then and now, striped bass, of course, is a prized fish. What makes them so special?
Well, of course, they're delicious table fare. But I think because they're so clever, you know, a bluefish seems like it's all muscle and not much brain. You know, they're in the daytime. But striped bass, you know, hunting for striped bass, there's some learning curves, let's just say.
It's a challenge.
It's
right?
a challenge. Yeah.
A lot of marketing is done to sell gear to fishermen, but the most expensive gear won't catch fish if you are not fishing at the right time and in the right conditions, right? So what are some of the factors you consider as you determine when and where to fish for striped bass?
Well, I always look at my tide chart. And, you know, one of the tools that has really helped me, and Jackie told me early on, keep a log. Even if I just wrote, you know, no fish, southwest wind, went to Gay Head, high tide, you know, whatever. And it's amazing how much I could learn from that log.
Interesting.
So now when I could see the patterns, you know, that when I fish a certain tides, it's not always, right. but it definitely, feed.
So you go back and you look at your logs and you say, these last 3 years, on this kind of particular night with the winds this way, and I've had really good luck.
Absolutely.
Oh, interesting.
But the one thing that's got me is 1980, I think, and I wrote about it in my book, May 6th, which is really early to catch a very big fish. And I was with Jackie. We were at Kwan Su. I can say that now because it was a long time ago. I caught my first 45-pounder.
Wow.
In fact, at that point, a lot of the guys thought they would say, oh, she's not catching those fish. Jackie's really the one that's landing them. But when there was, you know, a little handful of guys there that day, and when they saw me land that 45-pounder, they said, I guess she does know how to fish. So now here we are, 30-some-odd years later? You know where I am every May 6th? No matter what, I'm right at that spot.
Yeah.
Have I caught another 45-pounder there? No.
You write that when you were fishing with Jack, he didn't waste time admiring the fish, especially if it wasn't a striped bass. You, on the other hand, would take a moment to marvel at the beauty of any fish that you landed. Did it surprise you at first that Jack wasn't interested in the fish the way you were?
It didn't surprise me, but I knew who he was. It was all about making money. It was a business. You know, we went fishing. It was work. We sold our fish to, we went down to Burgess's the next morning, slapped them on the dock. Mm. They took them off to Fulton Market, and we'd go the next day and get a check. And it was all about money, and we made some decent money. I was waitressing. He was a butcher, so we definitely supplemented our, you know. So when we were fishing, if the fish was there, he would, you know, if I bent down, oh, Jackie, look up. Get up. Get to work.
get that in the water, yeah. So you spend a lot of time fishing at night because that's the best time to catch striped bass, but you're not fearless. In fact, you write about being afraid of fishing alone at night. So how do you overcome the fear?
Well, just keep going. You know, it didn't come naturally for me to fish in the dark, but time after time, you know, and I think I got to identify, oh, that's just the wind going through the trees, or that's just a deer running by me, you know. But in the beginning, when you're fishing in the dock, every little sound, it's like, you know, it's the boogeyman.
Yeah. All right, so there's a chapter of your book titled The Squeaky Reel.
Yes.
And that describes an experience you had fishing one night, so I'm hoping that you would read that for
us. Sure. Let's see. This is Chapter 22, The Squeaky Reel. After fishing the shoreline for many decades, it's become second nature for me to drive alone down long, desolate roads in the darkness to access some of the best fishing spots. Many evenings from May through November, I fished North Neck on Chappaquiddick Island. To get there, I board the 3-car ferry on time near Memorial Wharf in Eggertown. When I exit the boat, especially during the busy summer season, I can feel the peace and solitude wash over me the minute I drive onto the tiny island called Chappie. About 2 miles down Chappie's only paved road, I turn onto North Neck Road. I weave my way along the bumpy dirt road and park my fishmobile in the small land bank public parking lot, which holds about 5 cars. I take plenty of time to make sure I have everything I need to fish for a few hours before I head up the shell-covered single-lane path towards the gut on foot. The path leads to a steep set of stairs down to a small slice of beach. Climbing the stairs is such a chore that I only want to do it once, hopefully after I catch a big fish. Clothed in chest waders cinched with a tight belt for safety, a hooded sweatshirt, and my lucky fishing cap, I wear a second belt that keeps my pliers handy around my waist, and to light my way, a headlamp around my neck. My backpack is ready with extra hooks and leaders, a rag, a tape measure, a bottle of water, and my rope if I intend on keeping a fish. Last, I carry my precious eels in a bag with an ice pack. On this particular night, there was no moon. It was so dark that I had to walk very slowly on the slippery, round rocks near the water's edge. The parking lot had been empty, so I couldn't see any lights as I scanned up and down the beach. I was casting and retrieving my eel ever so slowly. I was relaxing in the darkness, but tensed with the anticipation that any minute I would feel the tug of a large striped bass. Suddenly, a figure appeared out of the darkness. My heart skipped a beat. But calm returned when a gentleman's voice said, "Excuse me, would you mind if I oiled the handle on your reel?" He held up a tube of Penn lube. I had become oblivious to the fact that my old reel was squeaking away with every crank of the handle, and I gladly accepted his offer. So we could both enjoy the silence and tranquility of the night. I told him I thought that I was alone and apologized for disrupting the peace and quiet. He smiled as he squeezed a few drops of oil onto my reel handle, turned, and disappeared once again into the darkness of night. Yes, peace and quiet.
We're listening back to a conversation with Janet Massinio recorded in the summer of 2019. She died this past December after a diagnosis of ALS. We'll have more after a quick break.
Since I was old enough to hold something, I've been holding the fishing pole.
Joe Carew of Marion.
Me, my mom, and my dad, we were all fishing that day, trolling the pogies, and then I could see the pogie on the top of the water, spinning and flipping. I told Dad, I was like, I think my pogie's dead, but bass, they swim fast, they hit the fish and stun it. Then they come back, open that big mouth, and they swallow it whole. And then I could see behind the pogie a huge tail come right up behind him and splash, and my dad screams. He's like, "Oh, there's a fish behind it. Just let out the line. Don't stop reeling up." So I let the line out and I was reeling it in. My dad sees it and he's like, "Oh my God, look at it. What?" And he's just like, "Get the gaff, get the gaff." He gets it and he just gaffs it and he picks it up, puts it in the boat. It was 51 pounds and 52 inches. So that's almost 5 feet. And so we're freaking out like, this is a big fish.
You're listening to the Cape and Islands NPR stations.
You're listening to The Point. We're revisiting a conversation with Janet Massinio recorded in the summer of 2019, just after the publication of her book, Casting into the Light. Janet died last month after a diagnosis of ALS. Okay, lucky cap. Do you always wear a lucky cap?
Oh, one of the chapters in my book is called, superstitions, quirks, and omens.
Because fishermen are superstitious people, aren't they?
Yes, they are. Yeah. So I do have, I have my certain clothes that I need to wear.
All right. So sometimes when you're fishing at night, you get the feeling it's not safe and you leave. So describe the feeling you get when you know you need to leave.
You know, it's just weird. I could be on a beach that I've fished for 35, almost 40 years, and usually I feel tranquil, I feel safe, and then I go there another night, and all of a sudden I call it the heebie-jeebies, and I don't know what it is. And you know, it happens more on the north shore of the island, which is a very rocky shore and it's not very, you know, sparsely populated. You don't see many fishermen there or, you know, it's not like going to Waskey Point where there's, you know, 25, 30 guys lined up. Or at Gay Head, mm-hmm. which, you know, I don't know, that end of the island seems to have a certain amount of spirituality to it since the Wampanoag Indians were the ones that, you know, settled there.
So you just kind of get this feeling, and you don't know what it is. It isn't anything in specific that's making you afraid. It's just go, okay, time to go.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, like I say in the book, sometimes, you know, we make friends with whatever the heebie-jeebies are, and I say, okay, we'll fish the beach together. And then there's times when I'm like, okay, I get it. I think I'm going to leave here. I'm just too uncomfortable.
Yeah. During your early years on the vineyard, you worked, as you mentioned, a waitress and fished whenever you could. And you write, you often sold your fish to restaurants, as you were talking about, you and Jack did, sometimes serving the fish that you caught. Was that how it was for most vineyard restaurants in the time to get fresh fish in the 70s and 80s? Was that the way they got it?
A lot of times it was, because in those days you didn't need a commercial license to sell fish. It's in my book. I think it was around 1982 when they finally made that distinction. Now you have to have a commercial license. Yeah. So we went to we sold to fish markets and, restaurants. And that was exciting. I'd go fishing and then, you know, I would serve my clients the same fish I caught.
Yeah. So once you started fishing with Jack, you were more accepted by other fishermen. Or were there still people who didn't want to see a woman out fishing?
Oh, there was certainly other people that didn't want to see a woman out fishing.
So how did you respond to negative comments?
I just ignored them. You know, when Andy line came out, Andy is a monofilament line and it's pink. It's a great line. You know, Jackie turned me on to it. It was a really, you know, he used to say it's as strong as a rope. And I was fishing one day on Chappaquiddick with my pink line, and some guy made a snide remark about, oh, you're fishing pink line because you're a girl. You know, I was like, you know, okay, buddy, do your research. You'll be using pink line in no time.
You can fish like a girl, too.
Yeah.
So what were some of the unwritten rules about fishing in areas with other fishermen, and how did you learn this etiquette?
Well, it's, you know, in fact, I think today, I don't think, and I hate to criticize today's fishermen, but there's more fishermen that want quick gratification. They don't want to learn to fish. They don't want to hunt. For me, it's a lot about the hunt. You know, it's like, where's the fish? I want to go catch a fish. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a matter of respect, you know, just learning to respect other people's territories. And, you know, if they want to tell you something, they will, you know, not try to pry anything out.
It can be very competitive.
Yes.
You know, Henry Winkler wrote a book about his trout fishing, and I thought it was funny that his wife also fishes, but they fish in different boats because he doesn't want her fishing in his spot. Because if she catches a fish on the other side of the boat, he's going to get upset.
I'm lucky my husband doesn't like to fish.
So you don't have that competition with him.
I tried to get him into fishing, but, you know, if I caught a fish first, he'd go, oh, you always catch fish. And I'd go, oh, please, dear Lord, don't let me catch a fish before he does. He's just not a fisherman. He's got too many other things on his plate.
So any saltwater fisherman in this region likely knows about the Derby.
Yes.
For those listeners who are unfamiliar with the Derby, explain how it works and its significance for fishermen.
Well, the Derby, we're going into our 73rd year, I think. I'm on the committee. We're a nonprofit organization. We give $30,000 a year in scholarships to our local high school. It's the biggest all-inclusive tournament in the world. You know, we have a kids derby, and then we have a kids category. There's fly rod, women. In fact, our women's category, we're still only about 10%. We have over 3,000, almost close to 4,000 people registered in the derby, and we're still only around 300 women, which is too bad. We'd like to get more women out there. But I'm so proud to be on the committee. We're elected volunteers of about 35 members. We start running the next year's Derby the minute the Derby is over from the first year.
And so can people not from the Vineyard or even Massachusetts participate?
Oh, anybody. Yeah, anybody we have people from Italy, Japan, Russia that come just to Martha's Vineyard, just even if they can't fish the whole Derby, they fish for maybe a week or a weekend.
Yeah. So in the early days, striped bass was the focus of the Derby. What are the other fish species that are part of the Derby today?
Well, today we have striped bass, bluefish, false albacore, and bonito, Atlantic bonito. At one point, we had weak fish, but then the weak fish seemed to disappear. But the first 20 or 25 years of the Derby, it was only bass.
Mm.
You know? Oh, actually, no, that's not true. The first couple of years of the Derby, it was only bass. In 1952, they put bluefish in. So it was only bass and bluefish, but nobody cared who caught the bluefish. You know, the prestige
because
was,
that's the striped bass.
That's the easy
tough one.
Yeah, who cares? Yeah, you caught a 20-pound bluefish, who cares?
Yeah.
But then over the years, they added the weak fish. And when they added the bonito and the false albacore, it really changed the Derby because you don't have to stalk them at night. They're a daytime fisher. Mm-hmm. Fish, you know, you catch them in the daytime. The gear is a lot lighter. There's a lot of people that used to be bass fishermen that now are elderly, and they can still fish in the daytime.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, we can make everybody happy.
Yeah. So you fished the Derby with Jack in 1984. The last year striped bass were part of the Derby before they were removed for 9 years.
Right.
Jack won the Derby that year, but your fish was a close second. So tell us about that.
Yeah, it was second.
Yeah.
It was a second.
Yeah. Yeah. It could have been first, right?
Yeah. He always
So how close was it? I
mean, well, his was 48.75 and mine was 45 pounds. And the third place was about 42 pounds. Mm.
Is it rare today to catch a 48-pound striped bass?
It is pretty rare.
Yeah.
You know, we've had derbies where a 30-something pound, a 36-pounder has won. The last couple of years, a few bigger fish have come in, especially from the shore. The boats usually get a bigger fish. But
yeah. So do you see catch and release gaining popularity among fishermen?
Yes, and we have had it on the table. We've had meetings, you know, all this winter, trying to discuss. We have a little bit bigger catch and release category this year, but you know, we're working on it. Mm-hmm. We're working on it. We're definitely not, we don't have a blind eye towards what's happening with the striped bass. We work closely with the marine fisheries.
Yeah. So the Derby does allow for catch and release then, right? Yeah. And how does that work? You have to take a photo? I mean, how does that work?
Well, that's what we're working on.
Oh, you still don't know? Yeah.
We're still, you know, that's...
Yeah,
you know,
because, boy, it's tough,
it's,
right?
It's tough. It's tough. We work with Greg Skomel, who, you know, he really helps us with statistics of the fish mortality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. As your fishing skills grew and you became more involved in the Derby, you realized no one was keeping artifacts from previous Derbies, and you set to collect and begin cataloging items. What were some of the surprising items you came across as you looked through old photographs?
Well, you know, I wasn't surprised at old photographs, but I was surprised nobody ever categorized them, because we don't have a building, we don't have any real estate, and people handed me big garbage bags full of pictures that were all stuck together.
Oh, no. Yeah.
So a few of us sat around one winter and we tried to put them in frames, and you know, and now we finally turned them over to the historical museum.
Mm.
So we have a new historical museum on the Vineyard, and anybody who can go there and they can ask, like, you know, was my father John Smith? Is there any pictures of him in the archives?
Yeah. Now, in your book, you include an excerpt from a 1955 newspaper article about Mrs. Albion Alley, who weighed in a 55-pound striped bass, and the quote, "She did it all by herself."
Yes, I know. And it surprised me that she wasn't, you know, they didn't name her first name. She was Mrs. Albion Alley.
Yeah.
You know, like I say in my book, we used to say that to my little Christopher when he was 4 years old, that he caught it all by himself.
Yeah. All right, so like many others in the 60s and 70s, you used drugs and alcohol, but by the mid-1980s, you realized that you were struggling with substance use. Today, addiction and treatment still carries a stigma, but 30 years ago, it wasn't really talked about. So what were some of the signs that you needed help, and was it difficult to admit that to yourself and others that you had the substance use disorder?
Absolutely. You know, and one of the things when I wasn't fishing, Jackie would say, "Come on, let's go fishing." And I'm like, "I can't go. I don't feel well." Or, you know, and I knew something was really wrong. And luckily, I ended up in Fall River in my first rehab. And I always say, I at first I thought I was a visiting dignitary there, but believe me, it's right where I belonged. And my life was going downhill. And one of the things was I wasn't fishing. I couldn't get it together to go fishing. And my job was on the line. I had a very low mortgage. I bought a house in the mid-70s. And, you know, I was a mess.
Yeah. So how was the experience of fishing different after you stopped using drugs and alcohol?
Well, 1984 was my first sober year. And that's when Jackie won the Derby and I came in second. So what a reward that was for me. And it was different. It was scary, you know, because I always had a bottle of brandy in my waiter pocket. You know, I used to call it my bottle of courage. Mm-hmm. And I thought, how am I going to fish without my bottle of courage? So it was, you know, well, everything in life was scary when I first stopped using because I spent a lot of years trying to run away. You know, like I say in my book, I ran away 3 times when I was 11. And then when I discovered drugs, that was my way to run away. And I'm still like that. You know, I don't like being a responsible human being. But luckily I have fishing. I can run away into my fishing.
Yeah. Was the experience different, though, for you? I mean, once you stopped using drugs and alcohol and you're fishing, did you find that it was a more enjoyable experience? Oh, I mean, you noticed more? You caught more fish, maybe?
I don't know if I caught more fish, but I definitely, it felt like a drug. You know, being straight felt like a drug. I noticed the sunrises, the sunset, the colors. You know, it was like all of a sudden my gray world became in technicolor, you know, because I didn't have all that stuff in my body. It was amazing.
Yeah. So Jack encouraged you to keep a log of your fishing trips. You mentioned that. Do you remember why he made that suggestion? And did he keep logs?
Yes, he kept logs. Mm-hmm. He kept logs. And he learned from a guy named Stevie Amaral, who learned from his dad, Gus Amaral. And Gus was, I think he weighed in the first bass of the first Derby. Mm-hmm. And, I'm so lucky. These were like the old timers, you know, and they passed down little nuances and techniques that I could have never learned on my own.
Yeah. When you think about it, and you mentioned like the things sometimes you would just say, you know, the wind and where and the tide, what do you do? I mean, do you sometimes keep a longer, document of what you're doing, or is it usually just short little weather and tide?
Well, now it's little short things, you know. Actually, there's a chapter in my book called Fish Logs, and I have a lot of the logs that, you know, I kept. But now, you know, now it's shorter. Well, it depends. Sometimes I could be a little long-winded.
And so when you look back on your logs, what are the things that stand out to you?
Well, the decline of fish, definitely, you know. And when I think about the times when we used to be able to keep herring, and we would go up to Gay Head. Alfred Vanderhoop would give us permission to go up to Gay Head, and we would net herring and use them for bait and cut the roe. Mm. And, you know, we used to have longline herring. And just the bass, it's just not so easy anymore to find them.
So were the logs useful for you as you embarked on this writing the book? I mean, what were you looking for in the logs as you were putting your book together?
Well, it wasn't just the logs. It was, you know, I started writing for On the Water magazine when they first came about. And so I started, to look through my old articles and start to put those together. And, of course, I was in Cynthia Riggs's writing group, and they encouraged me to use that as the foundation of my book.
Yeah. So as you look back on that and the articles as well, you can see trends, right? What, like you're saying, what fish we used to be able to catch and what we don't so much now.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And you talk about there being less bass, and of course not, like, to catch a 45-pound bass now would be, like, you know, crazy good.
Yeah.
So things have changed a little bit. So the hunt is even tougher now, right?
Right. The hunt is even tougher. Even the clothes that we wore. Years ago, during the Derby, I had so many clothes on, it would be so cold, my toes would be frozen. Now, the last few years, in October, there's days when I'm out in short sleeves at night, you know.
So the weather's changed.
The weather has changed. The water temperature has changed. The species have changed. People's attitudes have changed, I hope.
Yeah, it's more women fishermen now, too.
Yes,
yeah.
That's wonderful.
We're listening back to a conversation with Janet Massinio recorded in the summer of 2019. She died this past December after a diagnosis of ALS. We'll have more after a quick break.
I was only 18, 19 when I was in the Navy. So we went fishing on a walk. Anywhere you anchored, you drop a fish line over.
Jack Duggan from Megansett.
I went out through South America, Brazil, Argentina, Cuba, England, Africa, Sicily, and all them places that I was in World War II. Half the time, you never caught a fish. Well, I come down here, and I caught more bluefish in this Cape Cod than anybody else did. I'd come up every day, except when they called Eustace Cove. We used to go in there, and we'd always come out with 10 or 12, 15 bluefish, and the bluefish would be that long.
You're listening to the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.
You're listening to The Point. We're revisiting a conversation with Janet Massinio recorded in the summer of 2019, just after the publication of her book, Casting Into the Light. Janet died last month after a diagnosis of ALS. Jack suffered from schizophrenia and never received treatment. He died by suicide in 1990. You lost not just a friend, but a person who shared a life passion. How did his death impact you and your love of fishing?
Well, it still impacts me. You know, I just feel, Jackie, when he was a teenager, which, you know, I was born in 48 and he was 10 years older than me, he started to see a doctor and they gave him Thorazine and so it whacked him out. So striped bass helped him for a lot of years, but when his schizophrenia came back and would say, Jackie, go to a doctor, he wouldn't go, you know, and I just feel bad. He was born at that time when they didn't know as much about mental illness as they know today. You know, if he was younger today, he could get the help that he needed.
Right.
So, I mean, losing him, you know, I still fish everywhere that Jackie and I fished, and I still feel him there. And, I can't replace him.
No.
I fish with a guy named Charlie Cinto. He caught a world record striped bass in 1967. He got a 73-pounder off a Cuddy Hunk. He's now 90 years old.
Wow.
And he's become a fishing buddy.
Yeah.
But he's not Jackie.
Right. And that passion that you both had, that was part of the chemistry between you, right? This is part of who you are, was part of who he was.
Yeah. He taught me how to cuss the bluefish, you know, those damn bluefish. You know?
So in addition to being a skilled fisherman, you're a taxidermist. So what got you interested in taxidermy?
Well, because in 1984, when Jackie won the Derby and I took second, I was going to wait until I had a 50-pounder, which most fishermen want to have that 50-pounder on their wall. And I couldn't find anybody to do a skin mount. So there was a man named Wally Brown who lived on the Cape, and all the fishermen back in the 60s and 70s and 80s have a Wally Brown on their wall. So I had a fiberglass mount done. And when that came back, I looked at it, and it was really beautiful. But I said, you know what? It's not a skin mount. Mm. So I did a lot of research, and I ended up going to the Pennsylvania Institute of Taxidermy.
Wow.
And learned my skill. And that's what I was doing the last 30 years. I'm now retired, but the good news is our new historical museum has taken my collection.
Nice.
One bass, one bluefish, one sea robin, one scup, you know, all that.
So explain what the difference between, you said, the fiberglass versus a skin mount. Explain what that is.
Well, like, you know, there's these big companies in Florida that if you catch a fish, you can just call down there and say, you know, I got a 18-pound bluefish, and they have a mold already made. And so they just pop a fish almost, you know, as close to your measurements as they can. They paint it up and send it to you. I've seen pictures. Usually when they paint them up, they have a assembly line.
Mm.
Everything I did was very hands-on. You know, I actually not molded the fish, but actually took a measurement of the fish so I could make a body for it, and then skinned it out, like on a 50-pound bass. That would take me about 8 hours of getting all the meat out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Then I would hand-carve each body out of a carving foam, and then tan and degrease my skin, wrap it around the body, sew it up, and I'm about halfway finished.
Wow.
Yeah.
There's a lot to this, isn't there?
There's a lot to it. That's why, you know, 30 years of it, I couldn't make a living. Luckily, my husband has a decent job doing as a landscaper.
Another passion, right? Yeah. Taxidermy. So people are bringing you their prized fish to mount. Was it stressful in the beginning? I mean, you know, this is somebody's prize fish.
Oh, my first few fish. Johnny Hoy, who's, you know, sings the blues. Yep. Yeah, he was one of the first bass I ever did, and yo, the pressure. Because when I was at school, I mounted 10 small fish. So now all of a sudden, I'm looking at these 50-pound fish. Bob Post gave me his Derby-winning 18-pound bluefish. You can ask my husband. I did a lot of crying. I would hurt myself. You know, I had to chisel out the backbone. I'd smash my hand. The fish would have to go back in the freezer for a week as I, you know, nursed my bruise. And I cried a lot. But, you know, it took a while. But, you know, people seem to like my work.
So taxidermy is both technical and artistic. Do both aspects appeal to you?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, of course, I wanted to be an artist. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for me, people would say, oh, it's beautiful art. But for me, it felt more like it was technical because, you know, I'd be tearing the fish apart so it was unrecognizable and then trying to put it together so it looks like it's alive.
And it's just fish that you did?
Just fish. I learned to do some birds, but I specialized in just fish.
Yeah, because that's where your passion is.
That's where, and we don't have a lot of animals except for skunks and raccoons.
And who wants a skunk, right?
I don't want to do a skunk, no. Actually, I thought about it.
So how has fishing on the vineyard changed in the past 30 years in terms of fish species and size? We talked a little bit about the bass and the size being smaller and fewer, but overall on the other things you fish for too, what's changed?
Well, you know, actually the Derby is a great record of, you know, it really is a good example of how the species and the sizes have changed because we have 3,000 people fishing for a month. And when you see a 36-pounder winning the Derby, whereas years ago it would be, you know, over 50 pounds, like I said, the weak fish have disappeared. Here's an example. Sea robins. When I first started my business, I thought I would donate to the kids' derby. We have a one-day kids' derby. Everything's free to all the kids. And I thought, well, I'll do a scup for the kids. And then it seemed like the littler kids only caught sea robins. Mm. So I thought, well, I'll give them a chance and I'll do a sea robin. For the next 8 years, not one sea robin was caught by the kids.
Wow.
Now, you know, many years later, we have sea robins back. So it's so funny. Some of these species just totally disappear out of our waters. I think some of them are cyclical, and then some are overfished. And that's where science comes in. Is it cyclical or is it overfishing? Yeah. And, of course, pollution.
Right, pollution.
You know, there's so many factors.
And the change in temperature in the water.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So how has access to shore fishing spots changed?
Oh, really bad. Thank God my husband's a landscaper. Every time he gets a new job, I'm saying, do they live near the water? Can you get me permission
to park?
Can I
get over there? Yeah.
You know, I'm grandfathered with a couple of people, thank God. But it's really been bad. And, you know, the secrecy back in the old days, I think it was mostly about money. Mm-hmm. Because we were selling fish, and you didn't want to give up your spot. Now, a lot of the secrecy is because, you know, there's less parking. And, you know, I've noticed the fishermen now, you know, if they find out where you're catching fish, they try to sneak in there. And sometimes if they don't respect the landowners, we get shut out of places.
Right. That's not good.
It's not good.
Yeah. Have attitudes of fishermen or etiquette or fishing changed?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think, you know, most of the fishermen are so wonderful. You know, there's always that 2% that can get us all in trouble. But really, you know, I think fishermen are wonderful. Yeah. And, you know, it's like you could have a totally different political view, spiritual view. I mean, I've been side by side with multimillionaires and not even known it at the time, you know. So it just sort of breaks through all those barriers.
Yeah, you're just a fisherman.
We're both there just trying to catch some fish.
Yep. Now, you mentioned you have that chapter on superstitions. Yeah. Are there some superstitions that are shared kind of generally with fishermen across the board?
I think the hat seems to be the big one. You know, but there's in my book, I write about there's a guy named Walter Leeson. As I was doing research to find out superstitions, quirks, or omens, and I said to Walter, I said, well, hey, Walter, do you have any special things you need to do before you go fishing? He says, no, I don't have that problem. He was kind of cranky. Mm-hmm. And I thought about it. It could be a real problem. You know, like going fishing. Oh, no, I forgot my lucky hat. Or right. I get into a thing about if I found a really nice piece of purple wampum, I was going to catch a big fish. And sometimes it worked. And then there'd be nights where I'd be like, I can't find a piece of wampum. I'm not going to catch any fish. Like Walt is right. It could be a real problem.
Yeah, it could be. And then it's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy, isn't it?
Yeah.
When you think this is going to happen. Now, had you had nights where you found the purple wampum and you didn't catch a fish?
Yes. Yeah. And you know, sometimes I would think if I'm in a really cranky mood or I'm having bad thoughts, I'm not going to catch a fish. You know what? It has nothing to do with what I'm thinking, right. What I'm wearing. You know, yeah. If I find a piece of one, it has nothing to do with that. But yeah.
But just in case, just you're going to pick that up, right? And some people have like a whole ritual, right,
yes.
That they have to go through. It's like, you know, they have to get dressed in a certain yeah. way and don't forget the lucky this or the lucky
right.
that.
Wear the hat a certain way.
Yeah.
My friend funny. Philip Willoughby used to say to me, he used to call me Minnow, and he'd say, you know, Minnow, you're probably just not holding your mouth right.
That's funny. Now, do you see more women interested in fishing today than when you started? And do you have any interest in mentoring the next generation of female fishermen?
Well, I was guiding for the last 9 years, and I did workshops. You know, I did 3-hour hands-on workshop. But with my book coming out and real life is setting in, I just don't have time
anymore. Yeah.
But
all right, so advice. Advice for that beginning fisherman who's got the same passion you do.
Okay, the only way I know how to catch a fish is to put your line in the water. Try to have a good knot, but you know, you don't have to have the proper lure. You know, if somebody says, oh, use a popper or use, and you don't have it, just put something in the water because that's the only way you can catch a fish.
All right, so I have to tell you a funny story. I lived on a lake in New Hampshire, and this little a friend of ours came up with this little guy. I don't know, maybe he was 5 or 6 years old. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're catching the sunfish, right, in the lake. And this little kid was fishing with Velveeta and just catching fish after fish with Velveeta cheese.
I believe it.
Yeah,
I believe
it. So, yeah, give it a try, right?
Yeah, you never know.
Who knows? It might work.
I've seen every rule and exception. In fact, I have a chapter in the book called Rules and Exceptions. I have seen every rule broken.
Yeah.
So don't let anything stop you. If you have that urge to fish, no matter if it's the wrong tide, the wrong day, the wrong wind, you got the wrong gear, just do it anyway. Yeah. You never know.
Because even if you don't catch a fish, you're still out there enjoying the nature around you,
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's part of it.
Yeah.
I can't hit a home run every day.
That's true.
Janet Macedo's memoir, Casting Into the Light, Tales of a Fishing Life. Janet, thanks so much for talking with us. So much fun to see you.
Thank you.
Janet Macedo died last month after a diagnosis of ALS. In addition to her skills as a surfcaster and writer, she was also a taxidermist. In 2013, we spoke with her about her taxidermy work for our series Creative Life. We'll post a link to that feature and her book, Casting Into the Light, at our website, capeandislands.org. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.
I can remember once when I was about 5, we used to go out on the breakwater and fish for chogsies.
Carrie Scheller of West Tisbury.
And I needed some new hooks. And I didn't have any money, so I went into my grandmother's closet. I knew where her purse was, and I took out a bill. So I went down to Fisher's store, which was right down there by the dock. That's Arnie Fisher's father. And I got 5 cents worth of fish hooks. And he began peeling bills out, and I'd taken a $20 bill. I don't know whether she found out about it or not. Only time I ever took anything scared the you-know-what out of me.
You're listening to the Cape and Islands NPR stations.